I've launched the Soho Forum as a labor of love. I have lovely people who've been assisting me, many of them family, like Naomi Brockwell, who is one of my daughters once removed, who's done marvelous marketing work. My son, Jim Epstein, who's a reasoned journalist, who is a volunteer usher. My wife, Hisako Kobayashi, who is a great artist. Two of her works are hanging downstairs. She's prepared the food. And thanks to everyone else who's helped. The Soho Forum will be meeting monthly, and it has a twofold mission, to provide freedom-loving people with sizzling public debates on important issues. Power-loving people are also cordially invited to mingle with free-loving people and see if they can soak up a love of freedom. The second mission is that the same people, freedom-loving or power-loving, should have an occasion for meeting and mingling with each other. That's what the wine and cheese is for. Downstairs, I'm told, if you offer wine and cheese, you'll get a big crowd. It turned out to be true in this case, as it always is, has been in the past. With respect to format, in an age of soundbite and speed talking, the aim of the Soho Forum is to slow the conversation down and allow people to speak in paragraphs. With that aim, the debates we sponsor will always be one-on-one rather than two against two. The burden is, of course, on us to invite people worth listening to who have a lot to say, and our two debaters tonight, Tim Lynch and Heather McDonald, amply fill that requirement. We'll have an extensive Q&A session with our two debaters, and hopefully you'll have the opportunity to mingle with them afterward at our reception, especially since Heather will be selling books downstairs. The author of the book, The War on Cops, recently published. All right. We have closed the voting. I pressed the button, and we are now going to begin the action. An Oxford-style debate is an intellectual sprint. It's not an intellectual marathon. To do the marathon, to really make up your mind, you've got to read Heather's book. You've got to read Tim Lynch's writings. But I do insist that such debates do shed light. They do raise questions. They do enlighten. That's the reason why we're having it. Rudolf Hauser, my friend in front, is going to be keeping time on the debate. It will be time limited. There will be 30 minutes for questions from the audience, and so that's an ample amount of time for you to raise questions. But right now, there's going to be 15 minutes for Heather McDonald to speak for the affirmative in favor of the resolution. There is a war on cops that makes everyone less safe. Again, I'm going to skip Heather's substantial achievements in bio, except to say that she's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and she has written a book called The War on Cops, which is on sale this evening, she will be speaking for the affirmative. Heather, please, 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for coming. I don't know if this is going to work with the attenuated mic here, but we'll try. I'm very honored to be here at the Soho Forum. When Gene first told me that this was going to open with a comedy routine, I thought that's very odd. This is not a topic that necessarily lends itself to stand-up comics. But then the more I thought about it, I realized it's actually quite appropriate, because the topic of race, crime, and policing has only become more and more surreal over the last 2 years. Now, I agree with Dave that Trump is by and large odious, but every so often even idiots can be savants. And in August, Trump gave a speech in Milwaukee decrying the loss of black life to rising inner-city violence. He said black parents have the same right as white parents to be able to walk their kids to school without fearing that their children will be shot. The reaction to this speech? The website Crooks and Liars said it was a mashup of Hitler and George Wallace. Former Obama advisor Van Jones called the speech despicable and shocking in its divisiveness. But for sheer absurdity, nothing beats the central claim of the Black Lives Matter movement that the police are the biggest threat facing young black men today. Are you kidding me? This year in Chicago, over 3,000 people have been shot, working out to one shooting victim every 2 hours. The overwhelming majority of those victims have been black. They include Tavon Tanner, a 10-year-old boy shot in August playing in front of his house. The bullet tore through his intestines, kidneys, and spleen. A 3-year-old boy shot on Father's Day and now paralyzed for life. 10-year-old Zariel Trotter shot in March. The bullet destroyed his spinal cord and intestines. And at least 15 other children under the age of 12 who were shot in the first 7 months of 2016 alone. In September 6th, the 71-year-old man was watering the lawn in front of his house. A teen cycled up on a bike, demanded his wallet, and when the man refused, the teen knocked him to the ground, shot him in his abdomen, and then rifled through his pockets to get the wallet before cycling away. Now, if you believe the Black Lives Matter movement, you'd assume that the police were responsible for a large part of those shootings. In fact, police shootings in Chicago have made up 0.6% of all shootings this year. The police have shot 18 people, 6 of them fatally, virtually all of them armed and dangerous. And yet, and here's more meat possibly for Dave Smith's next comedy routine if he sort of changes the focus a little bit, Black Lives Matter activists want to disband the Chicago Police Department. Well, good luck with that. We're already seeing a slow-motion disbanding of the department with pedestrian stops down 82% this year, leading to a 54% increase in homicides and shootings, which already was up 25% in violent crime. So in order to answer the question, is there a war on cops, we first need to answer the question, is there a police war on blacks? President Obama, Hillary Clinton, the mainstream media, all of academia, and of course the activists sure claim that there's a police war on blacks. Just hours before 5 police officers were assassinated in Dallas in July by a gunman who wanted to kill white cops in particular, Obama gave a speech from Poland, laying out statistics that he thought proved his eternal point that the police are biased against blacks. Blacks are arrested at twice the rate of whites, he said. Well, now, I've not seen this particular statistic before, but I readily concede it, given the incidence of crime. Blacks commit homicide, for example, at 11 times the rate of whites. Shooting incidents are even more disproportionate. If blacks are arrested at twice the rate of whites, that only shows that police are going to where crime is happening. But the amazing thing was this. After the Dallas police assassinations, Obama had the gall to reiterate his racist cop theme during the memorial service for the Dallas cops, claiming that black parents were right to fear that their children will be killed by a cop every time they go onto the street. This is a rank falsehood and pure statistical innumeracy. Obama, however, is hardly alone in choosing exceedingly odd moments to accuse the cops of lethal racism. After 3 police officers in Baton Rouge were assassinated also in July, Hillary Clinton went to the NAACP to say, quote, "Let's admit it, there's clear evidence that African Americans are killed disproportionately by the police compared to any other group." Oh, really? Well, let's look at that evidence. Last year, the police lethally shot 987 people, the vast majority armed and violently resisting arrest. That's 1 fatal police shooting for every 10 deadly weapons assaults on a police officer. Though you would never know it from the media coverage, whites made up 50% of those police victims, blacks 26%. If the media chose to focus exclusively on the white victims of police shootings, the public would think that there was an epidemic of police shootings of whites. In fact, that 26% share of black victims is far less than would be predicted by blacks' crime rates. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, in the 75 largest counties in the U.S., which is where most of the population resides, blacks commit 2/3 of all violent crime there, even though they're only 15% of the population in those counties. In New York City, according to the victims and witnesses to crime, not the police, this is the victims and witnesses speaking, blacks commit 75% of all shootings, though they're 23% of the population. Add Hispanic shootings to black shootings, and you account for 98% of all shootings. Whites, by contrast, are 34% of the city's population. They commit less than 2% of all shootings. Now, police shootings are going to occur overwhelmingly, disproportionately, where police confront armed and resisting suspects, and that's unfortunately in minority neighborhoods. Contrary to the Black Lives Matter narrative, a police officer is 18 and a half times more likely to be killed by a black male than an unarmed black male is to be killed by a police officer. Four studies have come out this year alone that show that if there is a bias in police shootings, it actually favors blacks. Roland Fryer, a Harvard economist, studied police shootings in 10 cities and found no evidence of racial bias. In fact, he found that white suspects were more likely to be shot than black suspects. But the Black Lives Matter narrative is utterly impervious to the facts. It spews hatred and vitriol towards the cops, deeply affecting the environment in which police operate in inner city areas. The war on cops is predominantly ideological and rhetorical. Black Lives Matter protests feature killer cops, KKK cops, and fuck the police rhetoric. After the Dallas assassinations, the social media lit up with gloating. They need more shooters in Dallas like the ones who shot the two pigs, read one tweet. Yeah, it's lit in Dallas, fuck the pigs, read another. Now in Dallas, it's payback time, pigs, went a third. The incessant message from the White House and the media that the entire criminal justice system is racist is even more consequential, however. Obama's rhetoric has profoundly delegitimated inner city policing. Officers working in inner city areas are now routinely surrounded by hostile, jeering crowds when they get out of their squad car to question a suspect. In June, a Chicago officer told me he'd never encountered so much hatred in his 19 years on the job. The job is basically undoable now, he said. Resistance to arrest is up. People are ignoring officers' lawful commands. And yes, there are such thing as a lawful police command. The constant message from the elite establishment that proactive policing, such as pedestrian stops and broken windows policing, is racist, has led officers in predominantly black areas to back off of just such proactive policing. This is presumably precisely what the critics want. Cops are driving by large groups of youth hanging out on corners. If they see a guy at 2 a.m. on a corner hitching up his waistband as if he has a gun, they're often deciding simply to keep on driving. Why get out of your car and risk an encounter that if it results in some sort of use of force caught on videotape could be the end of your career? Now, this depolicing, again, may be what the cop critics want, but it is certainly not what the law-abiding residents of inner city areas want. I have never gone to a police community meeting in a high-crime area such as South Chicago, Central Brooklyn, or South Harlem, where I have not heard a variant of the following commands. We want the dealers off the corners. You arrest them in the back the next day. Why can't you do something about the kids hanging out on my stoop, smoking weed and loitering? I spoke to an 82-year-old cancer amputee in the Mount Hope section of the Bronx who told me, "Please, Jesus, send more cops." The only time she felt safe to go to her building lobby was when the police were there, because otherwise it was colonized by trespassing youth selling drugs and harassing the residents. Now, as a result of this fall off in proactive policing, violent crime in black areas has shot up since the activation of the Black Lives Matter movement in August 2014. Last year, homicides in the 56 largest cities rose 17%. That's the largest one-year increase in over two decades. But in cities with large black populations, the homicide increase was even larger. In Milwaukee, homicides were up 74%. In Cleveland, 90%. In the first half of this year, murders in the 51 largest cities were up 15%. And compared to 2014, homicides are up 32%. Now, it would be preposterous to suggest that the Black Lives Matter hatred is not also inspiring violent attacks on officers themselves. On Friday night, a black gunman ambushed a Philadelphia police officer sitting in her squad car, firing 18 shots at her. Last Tuesday, a black driver in Phoenix drove at high speed into three cops outside a gas station. In July, a black man in Indianapolis fired into the home of a police officer at 2 a.m., yelling obscenities at the police. He was wearing a Fuck the Police t-shirt. The other side said Black Lives Matter. Three gangs in Chicago have made a pact to assassinate officers. Now, like all such non-lethal attacks on officers, these assaults got virtually no national media coverage and only fleeting local coverage because they did not fit the Black Lives Matter narrative. Gun homicides against officers are up 46% this year as of today. So far, the rise in violent crime as a result of the mendacious, rhetorical war on cops has taken black lives almost exclusively. That rise in black homicide deaths should concern anyone who cares about racial justice. Even before the current crime surge in inner city areas, blacks died of homicide at six times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. That's a problem. And Trump, I never believe I would have said he's right about something, but he's right to say that that's something that we should be paying attention to. But if this poisonous anti-cop rhetoric continues, don't expect the rising violence to stay confined to inner city areas. Already in Chicago this year, there have been drive-by shootings and robberies on the Gold Coast. If the unjustified racial war on law enforcement continues, the historic and wholly unforeseen 20-year crime decline that this nation has enjoyed since the mid-1990s will reverse itself, and city dwellers across the country will lose the freedom of movement and freedom from fear that they have come to take for granted since the start of proactive policing in the early 1990s. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Heather. Yes. Thank you, Heather. Tim Lynch, his full bio is on our website. Tim Lynch is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and you can read his full bio on the website. He will have 15 minutes to speak against the resolution, "There is a war on cops that makes everyone less safe." Tim?
I was worried about this podium, but it looks like it's going to work. I want to thank Gene Epstein for putting this program together and for inviting me to participate. I have a lot of ground to cover, so I'm just going to jump right in. What I want to do this evening is walk you through 10 police practices that have come up over the past few years and explain why I think these practices need to be reformed, and how the change in these police practices can be reformed without making us less safe. Heather made some good points in her presentation, but I think it only tells part of the story. When you hear my part of the story, I think you will come to the conclusion that there is no war on cops. Let me start with secret legal settlements regarding lawsuits about police brutality. The Baltimore Sun ran a series of articles about civil lawsuits that were brought against the Baltimore Police Department. Since 2011, that city has paid millions of dollars in court judgments and settlements. The city agreed to pay $6.4 million to the family of Freddie Gray, the young man whose spine was snapped riding in the back of the police paddy wagon in that city. Now, the reporters for the Baltimore Sun discovered that the government in Baltimore had an unusual demand during settlement negotiations regarding police brutality. They said, if you take the money, then you cannot discuss what had happened in public. They can't discuss their case with reporters. They can't discuss the case in forums like this. They can't appear in a documentary film. They can't even testify before Congress. If you take the money, there's this provision in the contract that says the case is done. You can't talk about it. Now, these provisions have the effect of keeping information about police misconduct from the community. How can voters determine if a department is doing a good job if the victims of excessive force and these types of abuses cannot tell us what happened? So this practice of secret settlements needs to stop. Number two, police unions and their labor contracts. Last year, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake in Baltimore went to the state capitol in Annapolis and asked for a legislative change that would allow her police chief to get officers who are guilty of criminal conduct off the government payroll. Now, believe it or not, under current law, officers that have already been convicted of serious misdemeanor crimes, such as perjury and assault, they remain on the payroll for many months as they appeal the department discipline to labor arbitrators. In many cities around the country, police chiefs will say, we already have a pretty good idea who the problem officers are on the force, but because of these labor contracts, we can't get them off. You know, we've seen this in the education context where we can't get the lousy teachers out of the schools because the teachers' unions have put in place red tape that makes it trouble to get them out. We're seeing the same thing in the context of police unions. It's very difficult, but this is a problem that needs to be overcome. Number three, tracking police shootings. When there's a controversial police shooting, good reporters want to provide this community with some context. How many shootings were there this year? How does that compare to last year? What about over the past 5 or 10 years? Turns out many police departments don't keep track of that information, or they don't want to reveal it to reporters. No one has been keeping track, so it's been hard to lend some type of context to these controversial police shootings that we've been reading about and hearing about on TV. It was only last year that several media organizations decided to put some resources into tracking police shootings around the country. The Washington Post received a Pulitzer Prize for their series on this subject. And the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, signed landmark legislation in that state saying that if there's any fatal police shootings regarding the police in the state of Texas, they have to report the incident to the state attorney general within 30 days. And every year there's going to be an annual report with a tally. These people were shot. Here's the explanation as to what happened. Of course, most of these shootings are going to be justified. But it's remarkable that we don't already have that information in place. Every state should have a state law like the one that Governor Abbott signed. Number four, how to handle questionable police shootings when they do occur. The best practices in this area, it seems to me, are to identify the officer who was involved and to have a separate law enforcement agency conduct an inquiry to ensure impartiality. California, Florida, and Connecticut have enacted laws recently to mandate that outside agencies come in to handle the inquiry, again, to ensure impartiality. But some states aren't there yet. They insist on not naming the officers who were involved or investigating the shootings themselves. Now, in these departments, this arouses resentment in minority neighborhoods in many jurisdictions because it seems that every police shooting is always deemed to be justified. In Milwaukee, for example, 25 years passed before an officer was just recently brought up on charges because the shooting could not be justified. Number five, municipal court reform. Now, every county and every city receives money when people pay off their parking tickets, their speeding tickets, and other citations. But some cities have been perverting this system by using citations in a conscious design to generate revenue for the government to meet their budget goals. Grover Norquist has called this taxation by citation. And this kind of came up in the aftermath of Ferguson about how the municipal governments there were operating. Grover Norquist said Ferguson had turned its police officers into revenue agents, and it stirred up community resentment because of it. And this is not just happening in Ferguson. I live in a suburb of Washington, D.C., in Fairfax County. There was a headline in the Washington Post last year that said, "Police ticket cars for needing inspection," while they're in line awaiting inspection. Now, when these bureaucratic abuses happen, it turns the community against the police. Fortunately, in this area, the left and the right have come together to say, this doesn't make sense. We need reform. Number six, the seizure of cash and property under civil asset forfeiture laws. Civil forfeiture allows the police to seize cash and property from persons who have not been convicted of a crime. They haven't been indicted. Sometimes they haven't even been arrested. But the police are out there taking their cash. The abuses in this area have been reported over and over again in the newspapers. I'll give you just one. What happened to a guy named Joseph Rivers? He was a young man. He was moving from Michigan to Los Angeles to start his career in the music industry. He had been saving his money for 3 years. And he got on a train to head to Los Angeles, so he had a lot of cash on his person, and his mother gave him like $2,000 to help him get started, because that's what mothers do. About halfway through his trip, police came onto the train looking for drug smugglers. They asked if they could go through his belongings, and he said, sure, go ahead. They found the cash, and then they said, we think this is drug money, and they were going to take it from him. And he said, you know, he explained what his situation was, that he was moving, that he needed the money to get started for his move. And they just shrugged. They're taking the money. And their rationale was that he was moving to a drug hotspot, Los Angeles. He said, if you take my money, I'm not even going to get home. I don't know anybody around here. And again, they just shrugged. Some nearby passengers on the train heard what was going on. They gave him some money so that he could get home. When stories like this happen, you know, it ripples out among relatives, neighbors, and friends. And again, it stirs up resentment against what the police are doing. So civil asset forfeiture needs to be reformed. New Mexico, their legislature voted unanimously last year to abolish civil asset forfeiture in that state. But that's an important victory, but a lot more work needs to be done in that area. Number seven, tracking in-custody deaths. The death of Sandra Bland has brought attention to the fact that we do not have good data on the number of people who die in police custody. You might recall she was the one who was pulled over. She got into a heated argument with an officer, and then there was a violent arrest. She was taken into custody, and she apparently committed suicide a day or two later. So her case got a lot of attention, along with Freddie Gray in Baltimore, about in-custody deaths. Again, reporters wanting to bring some context to this problem, and there's just a lack of data. Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin, to his credit, signed legislation after an incident in that state. Now there's going to be an annual report of anybody who dies in the custody of Wisconsin police. There will be an annual report and an annual tally. Now, Governor Walker is not part of this war against police. Okay, he would not allow himself to be a part of something like that. He's doing the right thing, enacting reforms that need to be done. Number eight, dealing with gypsy cops. I don't know how many people here have heard this expression, but a gypsy cop, it refers to a person who resigns his position before he can be fired or disciplined, and then he moves over to a different police department, joins that group, gets into trouble, resigns again, and then moves to another jurisdiction. So they're moving around. That's how that expression got started. Now, this came up in the Tamir Rice case in Cleveland. This is the 12-year-old, you might recall, who was playing with a toy gun in Cleveland. A police cruiser came up. They had gotten a report of a person with a gun. Within seconds, he was shot and killed. And then as people dug into the story, the officer who was involved in that shooting, he was initially hired in a suburb of Cleveland, and they dismissed him. And the internal report said that he was immature, lacked judgment, wouldn't be a good police officer. But the Cleveland police hired him, and then a tragedy resulted. Now, teachers and doctors can lose their state licenses for unprofessional conduct, but many states lack procedures to decertify officers. This is a problem that has been festering for years. It was reported just a week or two ago in the New York Times. Policymakers have simply failed to address it. So a lot of these criticisms, you know, it's not on the police departments. It's about on the civilian oversight authorities. They're not doing their job to make sure we have good police practices. Number 9, the shooting of family pets. Over the past few years, we've seen more and more videos on social media concerning the police shooting of family dogs. There was a good documentary on this subject last year that I recommend to you. It's called Up Dogs and Men. There's lots of estimates out there. They vary, but some estimates say that as many as 20 pet dogs are killed every day across the United States. If that's accurate, that comes to about 7,000 per year. Now, everybody agrees that the police have to be able to defend themselves, but this boilerplate language that goes into police reports saying, well, it was necessary to shoot the dog, that's not going to cut it anymore because we've got so many of these videos coming up that show that the dog wasn't a threat, that he was tied up, or that the dog was going in the other direction. I mean, we've got reports of chihuahuas being shot, of small golden retrievers that were obviously not a threat. You know, in this area, postal workers, they receive regular training because they have to deal with the dogs as well. And they're trained, all of them are trained on a regular basis. And the officials at the postal department will say, you know, every once in a while there is a bite, but we haven't had any serious incidents. It almost never happens. This is another area the police need this type of training so that these types of tragedies can be avoided. If you want to turn families and neighborhoods against the police, let these incidents continue. This is something that needs to be addressed. Number 10, military weapons and equipment. 2 years ago, President Obama issued an executive order that put some restrictions on the flow of military weapons to local police departments. I mean, you've probably seen the stories. M16s, armored vehicles, bayonets, grenade launchers are flowing from the Department of Defense to local police departments. And these acquisitions are frequently accomplished without even the knowledge of the locally elected officials. Last year, a police chief in Vermont decided to return the military weapons because he thought his officers were beginning to view routine police work through a military-type mindset. Unnecessary confrontations, unnecessary violence. It's another area that needs to be reformed. I'm almost out of time, so let me wrap up. We have in the United States about 18,000 police departments, and they fall along a spectrum. At this end of the spectrum, very good departments, very professional, very effective at what they do. At this end of the spectrum, we have some dysfunctional police departments, like Baltimore, like in Chicago, some other places. They do not hold misconduct, persons who engage in misconduct accountable, and they've got counterproductive tactics. Heather's right. Some police officers have been unfairly attacked. But we also have to face the reality that many departments have serious problems and that reform is urgent. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Tim. Before we open it up to questions from the moderator and from the audience, there will be 5 minutes of rebuttal, first from Heather and then from Tim. 5 minutes for you, Heather.
Well, thank you for that presentation, Tim. I learned a lot from it. And I, of course, agree that policing should be transparent, that we need accountability. Tim, in his ninth point, said officers need training on avoiding dog shootings. I would say they need training above all on tactics to make those excruciating shoot-don't-shoot decisions with better accuracy. Unfortunately, the Obama administration is pushing some fraud known as implicit bias training, which is based on this false conceit that the police are involved in racially biased shootings. But yes, officers need more training. But I don't think Tim really addressed the central point of whether there is a war on cops, a rhetorical war on cops that is tied to the Black Lives Matter movement. He has not addressed the lived, visceral experience of officers working in the streets these days. I spoke to an officer, an emergency services officer working in the Bronx, who was trying to free a woman from an overturned car in a car accident. And a guy came up into the accident scene, stuck the cell phone in the officer's face, and refused commands to get onto the corner. He said, "You can't make me do that." Another officer was helping a mentally challenged young boy who had overturned his shopping cart and was helping him. The crowd that surrounded that officer was jeering, was involved. The tension was enormous. In Chicago, if you want to see what it's like, there was a video that a Chicago Tribune reporter took of officers responding on the South Side to a shooting. They were taunted for an hour by a group of teens, some of whom shot off another gun in an alley just for the fun of seeing officers run towards a potential another victim, shouting, "Run, bitch, run," at the cops. What is happening, again, on the streets now as a result of this false narrative is extremely incendiary. Law and order is breaking down in inner city areas. Now, this is not to say that there have not been some very, very bad police shootings over the last 2 years. The Laquan McDonald shooting in October 2014 in Chicago, followed by a cover-up, was atrocious. Bad tactics. The Walter Scott shooting in North Charleston was also atrocious. But those are aberrations and not the norm. Mr. Lynch mentions a $6 million secret settlements to police victims of police shootings and mentions the Freddie Gray $6 million settlement. Well, that was not a case of lack of transparency. We had court proceedings, and three of the officers, two of them were actually acquitted, one was a hung jury, and the prosecutor, the vindictive, insane crusader Marilyn Mosby, eventually dropped the other three cases because there was no evidence against those cops. I would dispute Mr. Lynch's allegation that the Baltimore Police Department and the Chicago Police Department are prima facie out of control or unprofessional departments. They are, again, responding to the incidents of crime. I was waiting for the militarization libertarian meme. I think the biggest problem with this is that the Pentagon procurement practices are so shoddy that they have all this excess equipment on their hands to get rid of. But it is not clear to me that transferring this equipment, which was bought at taxpayer expense for apparently no reason, is such an awful thing on cops. In the Orlando terror shootings at the Pulse nightclub, the officers used an armored vehicle to try and break down a wall to save some of the remaining victims. In San Bernardino, the New York Times recently described the scene of that carnage, the bodies writhing in torture, in pain, begging to be taken out of that scene. The officers again used military-style weapons and armored vehicles to respond to the hundreds of rounds that had been shot off. In Dallas, a police robot was used to try to get at the active bunkered shooter. So, yes, of course, we don't want an excessive use of force, but I don't think it's proven that we have it. But I would submit that Mr. Lynch has not disproven the proposition that there's a war on cops that is putting eventually lives at risk.
Thank you, Heather. Yeah. 5 minutes for you, Tim, before we throw it over to questions.
Okay, thank you. a few points. Like, let me take a specific example of, like, stop and frisk. Heather's a big champion of stop and frisk. There are others like myself who disagree, who believe that this is a counterproductive tactic that too often violates the constitutional rights of people, especially minorities. Now, take what's happened here in New York City. A lawsuit was brought by civil liberties organizations. So it went to federal court. They made their case. The city made its case. And the federal judge decided that the city's policy was unconstitutional. Mayor de Blasio ran on a platform of scaling back stop and frisk. New York City voters elected him, and he scaled it back. This is not a war. This is using American courts and the American political system. I recently noticed that the Daily News has reversed its position on stop and frisk. They thought after the judge's ruling that violent crime and homicides were going to spike, and they had to admit, hasn't happened. They've reversed their position. Now, again, there are police departments around the country. This isn't just me saying this. This isn't just a libertarian critique. John Timoney, former official with the New York City Police Department, went on to be police chief in Philadelphia and Miami. In his memoir, he said when he took over Philadelphia's police department, he said in his memoir that the disciplinary system was a joke. He would fire people, and then 10 months later, a labor arbitrator would reinstate that officer back onto the force because of the red tape of these police union labor agreements. Now, these things ripple out. These things have big effect because I agree with those who say, look, overwhelming number of police officers are good guys who are trying to do a good job. Let's say it's 98%. But these 2%, they can't get them off the force. These are people going out into the neighborhoods every week. And then who can blame the minorities in their neighborhoods to say, well, if they're not getting these bad guys off the force, it's not just the bad guys, it's the system. There's something wrong here because the bad guys are not being held accountable. Now, Heather's argument, it seems to me, boils down to stop criticizing the police so much so that they can bring down the crime rate. My argument is that we have to assess a police department by at least three criteria. First, are they maintaining high standards of ethics and professionalism? Second, are their tactics consistent with the Constitution and fundamental ideas of justice? As I said, the civil asset forfeiture laws where the police just come and take people's cash, that's just wrong. I applaud New Mexico for what they're doing, moving away from that policy. Number three, are the tactics effective in delivering public safety? So I think we have to judge police departments by three criteria, not just whether they have tactics that are aimed at bringing down crime. Thanks.
Thank you, Tim. Think about the question you want to ask, and please line up to ask a question just a little bit before the first row. I'm going to begin by taking moderator's prerogative to first ask a question of Tim and then ask a question of Heather. Tim, is there a degree to which you and Heather are both right, which would make not only you right, but Heather right? In this sense, Heather seems to agree with some of your reforms. She's saying, she's open to them. Some of the things you've suggested, they're worth doing. But would you agree, however, with the resolution that says that while there is a need for reform, a need for correction, the war on cops that she is referring to is the idea that cops are all bad and that it's making everyone less safe, which is admittedly a strong statement that she identifies with. It's making everyone less safe because there has been, as she seems to document, a spike in crime. Would you say that there is still a war on cops, given the spike in crime that she talks about, despite the need for reform that you cite?
Well, in my opinion, Heather tells some truths, and she backs up, some of the ugly rhetoric that you hear out there. There are people that have a hatred for the police. There's no question about it. If you go on the internet and you look at Twitter feeds, you're going to find ugly things. But I guess where I disagree and why I come to the other conclusion about the proposition that there is no war on cops is that's not the full story. It's not the full picture. There's a lot of constructive reforms being done out there. I've named some of them. So in general, in the big picture, I disagree that there's a war on cops.
Thank you, Tim. My question to Heather. Heather, I am I look at data for a living, economic data, as well as murder data and so on. And with respect to the data you cite, what I seem to have noticed is that while there is a tick up in the murder rate, a tick up in some of the data that you speak of nationwide, and while it's increased in certain localities, what I seem to be impressed by, and I want to ask you about, is that even while the crime rate was falling in the 90s and into the aughts, it was not a straight line. You did see ticks up. You did see backups. And so is it really true that everyone is less safe, or might it be the case that what we are really noticing is a little bit of, if you don't mind the callous statement, data noise, which has happened before while the crime rate is falling? And so is it possible that you are citing specific cities, specific anecdotes that you could have cited 10 years ago, and that, in fact, the broad trend is not really disturbing given the fact that data, that murder rates do not fall in a linear fashion?
Excellent question, Gene. I've termed this twin phenomenon of depolicing and the resulting increase in crime as criminals get emboldened, the Ferguson effect. This has been very controversial. As soon as I named this, the American Society of Criminologists sent out a note saying, take her down. And one of the early Ferguson effect deniers was Richard Rosenfeld at the University of St. Louis in Missouri. And he claimed that there was no such Ferguson effect. He has since publicly reversed himself in a report, no less, for the Obama Justice Department that came out in June of this year. And he concluded that the 17% increase in homicides in the 56 largest cities was real and nearly unprecedented. I agree. Crime does not follow a straight line. And there have been blips. And if the crime increase peters out, then it will prove to have been a result of this current virulent moment. That doesn't mean it's not a real increase driven by the Black Lives Matter narrative. But if that narrative changes, if we get a different presidential administration, things may go back to normal. And I would also say that the Ferguson effect is happening precisely where one would predict. If officers are being told that they're racist for engaging in proactive policing in high crime minority neighborhoods, that's where you'd expect them to back off of proactive policing, and that's where crime is going up. And that's what's going on. It's in black cities where the crime rate has been so scary. Whites have been largely unaffected. I find it so bizarre that Trump, when he talked about this, was accused of using racial dog whistles. If he was a racist, he wouldn't worry about it because it's not white lives that have been taken to date. It's black lives. And that's what the concern is.
Thank you, Heather. We have a number of people lined up. I do have to impose a requirement that you ask a question with a question mark. Try to limit the speech recognize that you can speak with passion, but speak with civility. Recognize also that Heather is going to be signing books. She'll have plenty of chance to lecture her later. And Tim is going to be making a beeline for the wine table, so you'll have plenty of time to lecture him. So ask a question and make it as incisive as you can. Thank you.
Thank you. A crime scene happens through the dimension of time or in stages. I will let you know. It's for Heather. I'm getting to that. So with that, it seems that you are talking about different parts of stages or different parts of the elephant with the blind men. But in that aspect, Heather, I do not hear any solutions that you recommend, whereas with Tim, I do hear solutions. Now, there is one solution that you did mention, and that is additional training as far as for officers in encounters with animals so that they don't shoot animals. I'm curious as to which other proposals of Tim's that you would embrace, but also, more importantly, which ones that you would not embrace and what proposals that you would put forth yourself.
Well, just to say what the solutions are, we have to agree on what the problem is. I define the problem as this false Black Lives Matter narrative that is resulting in depolicing and is resulting in black lives being taken. The solution to that narrative is to stop the narrative. The solution is to start telling the truth about policing, the fact that it's data-driven, and that it is responding to law-abiding residents in inner-city areas who beg the police to restore public order. The police cannot respond to those heartfelt requests for protection without generating the same racially disproportionate statistics that the Justice Department will use against them or the ACLU in its next racial profiling lawsuit. When I was talking about better training for the police, I was not referring simply to dog shootings. I was referring to tactical hands-on shooting, simulator, realistic street situation training. I know an officer in Chicago who pays for his own tactical training because the department can't afford it. What I would not agree with, I wasn't clear if when Tim was talking about removing investigations of police activity from the department itself. That's new to me. I'm not necessarily opposed to it. What I would be opposed to is the situation we have in New York State, where police officers are uniquely set aside from the traditional grand jury proceedings, and we've created a special prosecutor to prosecute cops. Well, I would think that a libertarian would understand that when you set up an agency of government like that with a mandate, prosecute cops, guess what you're going to get? Cop prosecution. So I would say that this budding movement to strip police officers of grand jury protections is wrong, and that I would disagree with.
Tim, you want to make a comment? Yeah. Comment?
Yeah. I was referring to states like Florida, Connecticut, and some other places that basically follow the rule that to ensure impartiality in a questionable shooting, you get a separate law enforcement agency to come in and interview witnesses, interview the police officers involved, and that sort of thing. I think probably the best practice in this area is if you can get a statewide law enforcement agency, like let's say the Houston Police Department has a controversial shooting, then you bring in the Texas Rangers to conduct it. In Florida or Georgia, they have a Bureau of Investigation. That's the type of reform I was talking about. The questioner is right. I mean, in this area, I know Heather has encountered it. There's lots of heated rhetoric on both sides. That's why I did try in my talk to get very concrete about specific policies that are problems in some jurisdictions that are acting to improve policing without making the community less safe.
Thank you. So my question is, given the documented increases in violent crime in neighborhoods like Chicago, for Tim, in neighborhoods like Chicago and Cleveland, what do you attribute those increases to, if not changes in attitudes among the police officers there that stem from the rhetoric levied against them in the media?
Heard the question, what do you attribute increases in crime in places like Chicago to?
Well, I haven't studied Chicago in depth, but we have to remember that as Heather and Gene were talking about earlier, I mean, crime trends don't go in straight lines. I mean, crime statistics and murder statistics have gone up and down before Black Lives even came on the scene. before we've gotten into the current debate that we've had over the past 3 years. Los Angeles went through a horrific period that Chicago is going through right now with homicides in the late 1980s and early 1990s. So did Washington, D.C. So sometimes it's a result of gangs fighting one another to get control over drug sales turf. In other instances, it is just where there are certain neighborhoods where people do not want the police involved. So even we're seeing situations where if your relative has been killed, they don't want people to go to the police and tell them who did it. They want to extract private vengeance. And so you're getting into this hit, counter hit, trying to exclude the police department from it entirely. And it's a cycle that has unfortunately spiraled out of control in Chicago, is what it looks like. And it's unfortunate that the police department there has gotten so bad. We have to remember that all the attention in Chicago started with the Laquan McDonald shooting. And remember, Rahm Emanuel tried to put settle that suit quietly and make it go away. It was only because a reporter sued and went to court to get that video released to the public that shook up the Chicago political establishment. After that, it was only after the release of the video that the officer involved was indicted, and that prosecutor who didn't act before has now been voted out of office. So there's deep problems in Chicago, and we just have to remember the happenstance of reform efforts that start with the simple release of a video, getting the incident on tape in the first place, and then releasing it because of the efforts of that reporter. Then the Rahm Emanuel administration took action.
Have anyone made comments? No. Okay. Next question.
Okay, my question is to both of you. Do you see a connection between the following the ending of stop, question, and frisk in cities, and Eric Holder's beginning the process whereby you can't suspend unruly, disruptive, or violent students from schools, which has happened in New York City? And also, coincidentally, at the same time, stopping the monitoring of mosques, okay? I wondered if you thought that this whole milieu was created where the potential criminals were actually victims and thereby causing the police to react against this deck being stacked against them, those three things together.
Well, on the stop question and frisk question, Tim is right to say New York City is the one counterexample with stops being down. And at present, violent crime has somewhat evened out. It was up in the first half of 2015 after the trilogy of lawsuits decided by Judge Shira Shinlin, using completely specious statistical methodology, comparing, as usual, police stops to population benchmarks rather than crime ratios. So using this statistical methodology that shouldn't earn you an F in a freshman statistics course, Shinlin declared the police department in New York guilty of racially biased policing. Stops dropped. In the first half of 2015, homicides and shootings were up 20%. And de Blasio and Bill Bratton were sweating bullets. This was following the pattern in the rest of the country. What Bratton did was get his hands on every police body he could and flood the shooting zones with them. Bratton has the luxury of a massive police department. And again, I'm sure this is not something to warm the hearts of libertarians, but when you're facing increases in violent crime and police are being discouraged from doing proactive policing, the only thing you got is bodies on the street. And that's what Bratton mobilized, and it resulted in 2015 ending with only a 6% rise in homicides compared to the average of 17% in the 56 largest cities. So You know, I think that New York City is a counterexample. Every place else where proactive policing goes down, crime goes up. As far as the school discipline issue, it's a travesty. It's ignoring, again, incidents of school misbehavior. It's using a race test instead of realizing that good students need order in the classroom. And to connect this to Muslim attacks on mosques, I think, is too complicated for this evening. I'm going to punt.
Want to comment, Tim?
I agree with that last point. The question was whether those three policies are connected and interrelated. I think they're all separate.
Hi. My question is for you, Tim. Presidential candidate Gary Johnson talks a lot about the war on drugs and how that has added to the incidences of more violent confrontations with people and the police. As a libertarian, would you comment on your thoughts?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I think William F. Buckley and Milton Friedman were right that the drug war has been a disaster. It's we're making all of the same mistakes we made with alcohol prohibition. You know, the money continues to flow into criminal organizations while, you know, they haven't stopped drugs from coming into the country, haven't stopped people from using drugs, haven't kept drugs away from the schools. I think we're beginning to see some positive steps in states like Colorado and these other states that are beginning to legalize marijuana. I think they should go further and call off the entire drug war. To bring it back into the context of this forum, though, I'm afraid because of the dynamics of drug prohibition, we're going to see many more instances in the coming years, because this sets up a powerful economic dynamic in our cities because of our lousy schools. Lots of young minority men, they drift thinking that they can make a quick buck by selling drugs in the cities. So they drift over into that work. And then what do we ask the police to do? Go out and make drug busts. So there's going to be these constant clashes between the police and what we ask them to do and these young minority men who are, stuck in these bad neighborhoods with lousy schools, and they think that they can make some money in the drug business. So there's going to be these constant clashes between the police and these young minority men. And Heather's colleague at Manhattan, John McWhorter, has written a lot on this subject, and I think he's absolutely right. If we want to improve racial relations, one of the most positive things that we could do would be to end drug prohibition.
To me, it's purely an empirical matter whether you get more crime or less crime by legalizing drugs. And this audience, it probably seems self-evident that you get less. I have not studied drug legalization. I sort of don't have a dog in the fight. I will tell you this, however. As I said earlier today, I have never been to a police community meeting, whether it's in the 23rd precinct in East Harlem, the 33rd in Harlem, the 41st in the Bronx, where I don't hear some variant of this demand. You arrest the dealer and he's back on the corner the next day. Why can't you keep him off the street? When Tim says we ask the police to make these arrests, the we in this situation is those law-abiding residents of inner city areas who feel that they are living under the thrall of open-air drug markets. Now, I know the moves here, and you will say, perhaps rightly, that the solution to that is legalization, because it's only violent because we've prohibited it. Again, I'm agnostic on that. I will say, however, that I will not accept a root causes type explanation for people getting involved in illegal activity like the drug trade. Well, a bad economy made them do it, because there are many, many males in inner city areas who are the clean people who have nothing to do with the illegal trade. And they're working, and they're making a moral decision to stay on the right side of the law.
Thank you. This is a question to both of you. And my question is, what do you think of the view sort of a third option, that you're both right, that you're both sides, two sides of the same coin, and that the issue is sort of a repeat of policies that were used in the past. For example, pressure from above, pressure from below, like used in communist takeover Czechoslovakia, or the student riots of the 1960s, or what some people have called anarcho-tyranny, where you purposefully create a situation where the police have, in effect, if not explicitly of a stand down, like in Chicago, where the crime is just exploding and the police is not doing anything, while at the same time seizing assets of innocent people riding on a train, sort of, in effect, getting the worst of both worlds, and which results in the people and the 80-year-old store owners in Harlem calling for more policing because they're being heard, while not realizing that what they're actually calling for is not the kind of policing that will help them, but the increasing federalization, militarization of the whole country and the taking away the rights of innocent people.
Similar to the question to the one I asked, but whether you're both right, and if you want to make a comment about that, Tim.
Well, Heather and I do agree on some things, but clearly we do have our disagreements. She's not as concerned, I think, as I am about this flow of military weaponry going to local police departments, M16s, police using these flashbang grenade devices when they execute search warrants. I mean, SWAT teams were originally created. The idea was we'd have a special unit for extraordinary occasions that would be put in place. They would be activated in situations beyond the capabilities of the ordinary patrolman. But now we've got these SWAT teams. Some places they're called special response teams. They're not just in big cities. They're in small towns. And their mission has crept beyond these extraordinary situations into routine policing activity, such as the execution of search warrants. For example, a town like Toledo, Ohio, their SWAT team goes out almost every day on average. See what I mean? Away from extraordinary situations to routine situations. So I think this is very concerning. We used to refer to police officers in this country as peace officers. They were there to respond to the disturbance and restore the peace. But when they come rolling into a neighborhood, you know, in armored vehicles and jump out with M16s in the middle of the night or very early in the morning, throwing flashbang grenades into people's homes, they're creating disorder. They're creating the disturbance rather than restoring the peace. So I think this is a big problem. We clearly have our disagreements about this and the drug war in general.
I respect that analysis and that discourse. I just think it's separate from what we're talking about tonight. What we're talking about tonight is the repercussions of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I can guarantee you, when the police are meeting at one police plaza in New York City in a CompStat meeting, they are getting up-to-the-minute data on where people are getting shot, where elderly people are being robbed. The deployment decisions are based on victimization, the tactics are based on victimization, and the issue of armored vehicles is just simply not coming up. What I'm concerned about is that officers are backing off of that discretionary type of enforcement that means you're not responding to a 911 call after there's been a victim. You are using your powers of observation to question somebody on the street or break up crowds of teens, out of which emerge drive-by shootings. Cops are not doing that, and the result is more loss of life.
My question, or I'd like Mr. Lynch to respond to a statement or that I'm was thinking about, that the reforms that you propose, first, I agree with them, and I think that they're sensible reforms. But the challenge that I think Ms. McDonald is raising is that there's not, let's say, the Black Lives Matter movement isn't proposing a reform program. They're not saying, well, here are our 10 points, or here are the things that we think would be sensible reforms in police departments. If they really thought that Black Lives mattered, then they'd focus on things like prison reform and so on, and in addition to police reform. But what I would say is, maybe it's in support of Ms. McDonald's point, is that, and that I'd like you to respond to, that she hasn't raised specifically, is that I think what is behind this movement is a very small group of radical left people. They were the same people that were behind International Answer, behind Occupy Wall Street. They are people that they're the same people paying them all along the way. And their job is to simply incite division in our society and prevent civil discourse from happening.
Excellent question. You made your statement. Tim.
Okay. I've seen some surveys, and I think I'm part of the 36% of Americans who know about Black Lives Matter but is not entirely clear about what they're all about. But I think the gentleman is wrong when he says that they haven't proposed any constructive reforms. Go on the web and look for Campaign Zero. That's where some Black Lives Matter people have proposed constructive police reforms. Or there's another related project called Check the Police, where some Black Lives Matter people are going city by city looking for these union red tape provisions that I mentioned and are asking that they be overturned. I've seen the same YouTube videos that you have. I see that are very disturbing of other Black Lives Matter activists who run up to microphones during events like this and start chanting and take microphones away from people like former Commissioner Ray Kelly and engage in some of that left-wing type shutdown, you know, events and that type of stuff. Of course, I think that's totally wrong, and that's why events like this, Gene, where we can have some civil conversations about what needs to be done, are so valuable.
Well, the Black Lives Matter movement may be small or large, but they have the most powerful weapon you can possibly hope for, which is the media and the university industrial complex that is the source of so much of this false victimology.
Mr. Lynch, it doesn't seem like you're actually making an argument against the proposition, which is that there's a war on cops. In fact, it seems like you're implicitly accepting that proposition, but then through your list of 10 reasonable criticisms of the police, you're implicitly stating that that war is justified. So if you actually wanted to kind of take that position that there are these legitimate grievances, don't you think you have to embrace the main strand of what is undeniably a huge rhetorical war against the police, which is that there's this well of racism that's, you know, occasionally erupting in violence against Black people? It doesn't seem like you're kind of taking a stand on that question.
No, and I'm speaking against the proposition, so I guess we have time for closing statements where I'll be able to reiterate my argument. But as I said before, Heather, in her book, critiques Stop and Frisk. As I said before, civil rights groups went to court to challenge it. They thought it was unconstitutional. The judge ruled in their favor. De Blasio ran on a platform against Stop and Frisk. New York City, you know, whether you agree with him or not, he ran on the platform and the voters put him in office. This isn't a war on cops. This is using our courts and using our political system. That's one example. I've given other examples. I think people debating police departments, how they can be improved, I think it's wrong to mischaracterize that as a war.
Okay. Hi, this question is for Tim. Tim, my name is Bob Friedrich. I actually ran for the city council and lost in a very, very close election in Queens. You cite reduced crime rates in New York City as evidence that stop, question, and frisk was not working, as not necessary. But as you know, crime is not static and reacts to conditions over time. And that's why it took years for crime rates in New York City to fall after stop, question, and frisk was initiated. Will you concede that shootings in New York City have now surged, now that stop, question, and frisk has virtually been eliminated, and rising crime rates may simply be a lagging indicator?
I don't think so. I think, I think the Daily News got it correct, that when the de Blasio and Bratton scaled back on stop and frisk, they predicted, you know, crime spike, homicide spike. It's been 3 years since the judge made that ruling, so a reasonable amount of time has passed. That's what led the editors of the Daily News to say, you know what, we were wrong. So I think that's a reasonable position to take and a reasonable evaluation of the evidence.
I've already addressed that. Crime was spiking in New York. We have massive manpower here. That put a somewhat of a lid on the crime spike, but look at Chicago. Stops are down 82% this year. Shootings and homicides are up 54% over last year's already 25% increase. The Rahm Emanuel, the depolicing did not begin in Chicago simply with the release of the Laquan McDonald video. Rahm Emanuel went to a crime meeting in Washington, D.C. in October of 2015 that was called to address this factual, lived, experienced rising violent crime rate that was happening in cities across the country. And Rahm Emanuel in October said that the Chicago cops had gone fetal thanks to the Black Lives Matter movement and were not interdicting criminal behavior.
This is a question that's addressed to both speakers. How can we expect the police to be absolutely perfect when they're human and they have their defects?
We should train, hold them to high standards, but unfortunately, when officers make mistakes, as every profession makes mistakes, the consequences can be lethal. Believe me, officers want to avoid those shootings with everything in their being. And those are excruciating decisions that none of us have to make. But I think there's been a reason we've heard as a indictment of the criminal justice system that officers are not often indicted criminally for shootings. And I think that's because the public understands the responsibility they bear and that they are not going out with criminal intent.
I agree that almost always they never go out with criminal intent. That's not the idea. However, when you look at certain tactics like these military raids that I was talking about, when they choose to execute a search warrant late at night or very early in the morning, they break down somebody's door, come in. At Cato, we kept a map on the Cato website about wrong door raids where police are going into the wrong house in the middle of the night. So the occupants of the house think that they're about to be attacked by criminals so that then they grab their gun. And then we have this tragic shootout between the police and the occupants of the home. The police obviously did not plan to go into the wrong home, did not plan to get in a shootout with an innocent person. But the tactics that they used, they were setting up a very dangerous situation by not doing a proper preliminary investigation before they went in. Sometimes it's just they bust somebody on the street, where'd you get the drugs? Some criminal might make something up and said, that house on the end of the street. And the bad police tactics when they start busting in on such a flimsy basis, middle of the night, puts homeowners in a very dangerous situation. So it's these tactics that I think need to be rethought.
In all gatherings such as this, there is always one really dumb question. and I'm going to ask it. And this question is for you, Mr. Lynch. If the Black Lives Matter movement is not conducting a war against the cops, why is it that the only time their activists respond is when a black person is killed by a cop, and they're completely, deafeningly silent when blacks are killed by other blacks, children shot, as Heather detailed, women, men, all ages, in their homes, in their parks, in their vestibules? Why is it that they're completely silent? And they're even talking about Palestine, but nothing about Chicago.
No comments on Palestine, please. Go ahead.
We're not about to go into that. I think there's two possible responses to your question. One is just that the media doesn't pay much attention to the black citizen groups that do protest about violent crime in their neighborhoods. The second part is that this group has chosen to focus on police reform. And, you know, it's like saying a group that focuses on black illiteracy, why are you focusing on that when so many people are getting killed in the inner city? Well, they've chosen to focus on illiteracy. This group is focusing on police reform. It doesn't mean that the members don't care about violent crime in their neighborhoods. Now, that doesn't mean that that criticism can't be lodged against somebody like, you know, the Reverend Al Sharpton. I think that's fair. If the fact that he seems to go to these, you know, highly charged cases where there's a white officer involved with a black victim. I think it's fair to ask, like, well, why are you only doing that and not doing other things? Now, maybe he'd have a response to that. Maybe the media is not covering other parts of his activism, but I doubt that. So that's my response.
Okay. This will be the final question. Walter, you already asked a question. Final question.
I wanted to ask a question directed at Heather, specifically about cameras, ubiquitous cameras, which seems like it's a huge change in law enforcement and that's had a huge impact. You know, I mean, you could say on one hand that all these videos that have been captured have really fueled the Black Lives Matter movement and some of the stuff that you are talking about tonight, but what do you think about the flip side of that argument, which is things like the Tamir Rice shooting or the Eric Garner killing? You know, before cameras were around, this stuff would have happened and there would have been no justice for these people. They happened all the time and nobody was held accountable. So can you please talk a little bit about on the camera topic?
You're referring to civilian cameras, not police cameras. I'm for police body cameras. I think they're a very expensive solution to a non-problem because I don't think the data simply explodes the claim that we are living through an epidemic of racially biased police shootings. In fact, a much greater percentage of white homicide victims are killed by cops than black homicide victims, 3 times as many. So the whole narrative is everything you think you know about police shootings from Black Lives Matter movement, reverse it and you'll get the truth. Again, I'm for accountability. I'm not sure that all of those shootings would not have come to light or bad shootings. I think in the case of Walter Scott in Charleston, for example, the forensic evidence would have shown that he was shot while running away. Cameras are fine then. That's something that we're going to live with. The problem, of course, is the media's choice to only focus on shootings of blacks, ignoring the shootings of whites, and to go with cell phone video that does not always capture the full encounter. Civilians are largely clueless about what it takes to subdue a suspect determined to resist arrest. We don't know. It can take 5 to 6 guys to take somebody down. And police use of force is never pretty, and sometimes it is grotesquely unjustified. Grotesquely. And of course there are officers who should be off the force, and I agree with Mr. Lynch that union rules that make it hard to remove known malfeasers have to be changed. But the media focus that has created this false meme of a racist epidemic of police shootings is wrong, and part of the problem is the selective use of video.
We are going to, because we had so many excellent questions from the audience, we're going to skip each side asking questions. We're going to go to the conclusion, 5 minutes for each. Then we're going to get the vote. Then we hit the food and the wine and the book selling by Heather. Heather, give us your 5-minute summary.
I am certainly not going to give a 5-minute summary. I think I've had plenty of opportunities tonight, thanks to the gracious hosting and gracious audience, to make my point. I would just say there is a war on cops. It's having lethal consequences. It's based on a lie, and it has to end.
Okay, I'm not going to give you Heather's minutes. You just get 5.
That's okay. Okay, a few final points in closing. Everybody here, I'm sure, remembers that dramatic escape of those convicted murderers in upstate New York. That escape caused a shakeup in the corrections department. And according to one article, it said long-lasting improvements in the department rest on how the conflict is going to play out between the corrections department and the correctional officers union. The article said remaking the disciplinary system would require concessions from the union, something that hasn't happened in decades. This is not a war on prison guards, okay? This is simply an attempt to improve a dysfunctional bureaucracy. And we're seeing the same effort at work with police departments in New Orleans, Baltimore, Chicago, Detroit, Oakland, and other cities. I mentioned Governor Scott Walker's move in Wisconsin to track in-custody deaths in his state. I mentioned Governor Greg Abbott's move in Texas to track police shootings there. These are conservative governors that are moving to enact sensible reforms. They are not a part of a war on cops and would never allow themselves to be part of such a movement. This phrase is thrown around too much. I did a quick search on Amazon the other day, and I found many titles there. There's a war on weight. There's a war on smokers. There's a war on welfare. And remember when the Democrats accused the Republicans of waging a war on women. You know, it's not true. It's catchy, which is why people are using it. It is very catchy. But folks, there are millions of people, black and white, who simply want to see reforms implemented in the police departments that are troubled. They're not at war. They want peaceful change. And even if you disagree with some of their policy proposals, we shouldn't mischaracterize the debate as a war. I want to close with a quote from a prominent voice in police circles. A few weeks ago, a retired detective from the NYPD, the best-selling author of Blue Blood, Edward Conlin, wrote an article on the proposition before us. This is what he said. While violent death has always been a risk for cops, it was a daily reality for African-American and Latino residents in the South Bronx where I worked. That's why the police were there. It seemed that there was a war going on, but most of us were on the same side. He continues, I don't believe there is a war on cops, and I don't believe that there is open season on black men either. Both claims, he said, are false. I think Mr. Conlin nailed it. So I would urge you to vote no on the proposition. There is no war on cops. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Okay, we're closing the debate. Please vote again on the resolution. Go back into your smartphones, soho.vote. Yes, no, or undecided. There is a war on cops that makes everyone less safe. While you're doing that, again, I want to emphasize, Heather will be downstairs signing books, chatting with people, responding to comments. I know Tim, who's staying locally tonight, is going to be hanging out. And we want people to get to know each other. We want people to commune over the wine and the cheese. That's the second mission of the Soho Forum. I hope you come back next month. That's, I think, Monday, October 17th, also on a Monday night. The next debate is going to be about robots. And it's going to be between two titans from George Mason University. They're both in the same department. They have a love-hate relationship. That's Brian Kaplan, who was absolutely brilliant, and Robin Hanson, who wrote the book about robots. They will be jousting about the robot issue. Robin has written a book. Robin actually is the guy who invented, who proposed the betting markets, the prediction markets, to the government, and that was shut down. I like Robin's point. You know, why shouldn't people be allowed to bet on important stuff? Why do they just have to vote on the presidential election, which I guess is also important? But he pointed out that it's important stuff. These are brilliant men. They will be jousting about robots on October 17th. Hope you come back, and I hope you voted on the resolution for or against. Anybody needs help doing the final vote? We want to know. Okay. So, all right, I'm going to close the vote. I'm going to close the vote and make the announcement. Okay, I just closed the vote. Okay. All right, I can give you the numbers, but I have to say that the person who gets the Tootsie Roll is Heather McDonald. She picked up more votes, and so Heather gets the Tootsie Roll, but she especially would like you to buy her a book. So do that instead of awarding her that. Thank you, Tim. I think we learned a lot from both speakers, and I want to give applause to them both. Thank you very much.